There are photographs crucial to this story that I have never seen. I don't know where they are or if they still exist. They were developed from a roll of film discovered inside an old school piano in an Arctic community in 1985. No one should ever see these images, but I wanted to verify their existence because they led directly to the arrest of one of Canada's worst criminals, Edward Thornton Horne. The photos were reportedly of boys in Thailand, or the Philippines, or Greenland, or the very community in which the film was found. The police officer who first saw the images knew at once that the photographer was a pedophile. The discovery of the images coincided with an investigation by social workers into sexual abuse involving school children. No one realized at the time that the teacher and principal of the school, Mr. Horne, abused boys in the community, and that there were victims in other communities who'd been suffering in silence since the early 1970s. Iqaluit Nunavut. I sat in a newspaper office inside the Tumit Plaza, a building located at the city's four corners, an iconic spot in the eastern Arctic where a restaurant called the Kamutik looked very much like a papier-mâché igloo when I first saw it. I didn't know much about the east, as that part of the north was called. It was May of 2003, and I had just arrived in Iqaluit from Yellowknife to write for Nunavut News North, a newspaper owned by the visionary entrepreneur and newspaper man, Jack Sig Sigvaldason. The paper in Iqaluit was just one in a chain of papers Sig owned that had reporters covering the north from Inuvik through Yellowknife, Hay River, Rankin Inlet, and Iqaluit. The workload was daunting. We were required to submit at least a dozen stories and photos to head office in Yellowknife for publication every week. We were a people-focused paper, often meaning soft, feel-good stories, but stories that were nonetheless important to people living in the north. Nunatsiak News, our competition, was more centered on what I called government stories, the kind that critically analyzed the new Nunavut government and the organizations created to serve Inuit. I was outside most days, stopping people in the street and asking them questions for our weekly street beat feature that included the person's photo, which I took with my camera. Right from the beginning of my time in Nunavut, locals would speak to me in Inuktitut, assuming I was Inuit or half. Being 5'3" with dark hair and facial features inherited from my father's side, long ago ancestors from the Silk Road made their way to Abruzzo, Italy, where my father was born, gave me a certain look that over the years has appeared to some people to be indigenous. In Nunavut, my look made me approachable, and this attribute would work to my advantage later when I arrived in small communities to ask people delicate questions. My co-worker at News North was Christine Kay, the journalist whose story about the burning school portable in Cape Dorset had caught my attention and would eventually change my life. We wrote widely about Nunavut, from hockey games to housing woes. Nothing ever took hold of me the way the Ed Horne story did. The crime beat on a newspaper generally did not interest me. I'd won a national award for arts reporting at my first full-time newspaper job in St. John's, Newfoundland. And when I headed north, I looked forward to all the Inuit art stories I would write. I planned to go to Cape Dorset as soon as possible to report on the carvings and prints being produced there. But the article Kay had written about the people of Cape Dorset watching an old school building burn in a sort of cleansing ceremony took hold of me. Maybe the story reminded me of the Mount Cashel scandal in St. John's, where I grew up. Kay's story mentioned a schoolteacher whose abuse of boys had occurred inside a portable building the people of Dorset burned. Feeling that this was a major story Canadians should know about, I spent the next several years trying to grasp the magnitude of Ed Horn's crimes in Cape Dorset and elsewhere. During my first year in Iqaluit, a police officer sat down at a table near me in a popular bar called the Chartroom Lounge and, breathing out a big sigh, said, "Just got back from Kimroot, angry little town full of Horn victims." There was a sense that local people knew what Horn victims meant. I didn't then. I would later visit Kimroot several times, and while there are some angry men who live there, some of whom were abused by Ed Horn, for the most part I encountered generous, kind folks living in a breathtaking Arctic community of about 400 people. I heard things about Horn beyond the crimes that drew me in. He was a brilliant teacher. He spoke many languages, including Inuktitut. He married an Inuk woman. He had children, one of whom became a police officer. He was Indigenous himself, a Mohawk. He had friends in the highest offices in education and traveled the world extensively on his time off. Everywhere I traveled in the North, in my early years there, I heard tragic stories about men who had been sexually abused by Horn when they were kids. Many suicides of males in the South Baffin region of the newly created territory of Nunavut were blamed on him. And over time, Ed Horn had become mythologized. The name Ed Horn alone conjured up images of a monster hiding inside his role as a teacher. But when I started researching the story, I realized no one really knew what happened at all. The actual scale of the crimes was unknown. Newspaper articles that ever mentioned a Horn criminal case, including one I wrote once, were not in depth and contained errors. Files relevant to Horn were not easy to access. Only victims knew what happened. And even then, there was a haunting silence. Those men, once boys, were desperate to forget what Horn had done to them. The criminal himself was a mystery. No journalist had ever managed to get more than a few words out of him. So where was he? What happened to him? Was he a free man? No one knew. Horn's crimes were never covered extensively in any media except superficial reports in the Northern Canadian press. This despite the fact he faced two court cases and served two prison sentences. There was also a major civil case that resulted in millions of dollars in compensation for his victims. Another criminal case involving four men and another civil case would follow. I knew the story needed to be told for the record, for history, and for the victims to have a sense of closure, even for children to understand their fathers a little better. I also knew that given the shocking subject matter, delving deeply into the Horn story might destroy me emotionally. So after conducting interviews and gathering preliminary information, I put the Horn story aside for several years. But the voices of friends in the North who first told me about the crimes stayed with me. I picked up the story again when I discovered an article in Inuit Art Quarterly about a Cape Dorset artist who had drawn images of Horn abuse. With the help of the co-op manager in Cape Dorset, I contacted the artist by phone in 2020. The compilation, the completion of this book, is due in large part to the courage of that artist and many other people in Cape Dorset, Kimroot, Sanikiluak, Iqaluit. The completion of this book is due in large part to the courage of that artist and of many other people in Cape Dorset, Kimmeroot, Sanikiluwak, Iqaluit, and Apex who wanted this story told and wanted me to tell it. All quotes and information in this book come directly from interviews I conducted, Northern media reports, and from court records, some of which were made available to me through an unsealing order. I have done face-to-face interviews with victims and their relatives. I interviewed police and judges, lawyers and bureaucrats, including former Education Department officials who had never spoken to a journalist about the Horn case. In fact, most of the interviews were with people who had never spoken to a journalist about the story before, including Ed Horn himself.